From the KBIA newsroom in Columbia, this is Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. I'm Claire Banderas, Intersection's producer. This week, we'll be hearing conversations with directors and producers bringing their films to the True False Film Festival this weekend. Our team spoke with a range of filmmakers, from Oscar-nominated producer of I Am Not Your Negro, Hubert Peck, to directors new to True False, like Laura Checkaway, and husband and wife duo Petra Letoster-Chaish and Peter Letoster. First, reporter Michaela Tucker talked with the director of the Jonathan B. Murray Center for Documentary Journalism, Stacey Wolfel, about the films and directors he's looking forward to.
What films have you seen that are coming to True False this year, and which ones are you really excited about?
First is I Am Not Your Negro, which is, of course, an Oscar nominee. It's a documentary people will be talking about in 20 or 25 years, which is a tough place to get to for documentaries. There's some terrific ones in the list here, but they won't all be being talked about in 20 or 25 years. But this one will be, and it just so well uses the language of cinema to take writings that were done 40 and 50 years ago, video footage from that time, and then the recreation of that era today, to take the issues we had with race back in the 60s and 70s and connect it to the problems we have now. There's one on the opposite end of the spectrum, one that's a very small film that people I think will like. It's in my crowd pleasers list. It's called Don Quixote, which is the obvious reference to Cervantes here, but it's a Spanish farmer and his donkey and his dog, and he decides to take an epic journey, and we get to see everything he does to make that happen. There's one called The Grown-Ups that looks at the sort of interesting situation in Chile where children with developmental disabilities never really stop going to school. And so the grown-ups in the title are a number of people with Down syndrome and some other conditions who are still attending school in their 40s or 50s. It's sort of hard to tell how old they are. They're more workers than students, but they still sort of consider themselves students. And it's kind of a little soap opera. There's a love story. There's a political election that goes on. And it's told in this way where we very seldom see the developmentally able adults in the film. It's almost all told from the point of view of the grown-ups.
And looking at the list of films this year, there are a lot of films that deal with immigration, refugees, race, identity, protest. Mm-hmm. How do you feel like this year's True False fits in with the current media climate that we're seeing and experiencing right now?
Well, that's important for the programmers there. And so race is an important part of a lot of these films where it's not necessarily about conflict. Something like Whose Streets is about Ferguson and the aftermath of that and the sort of claiming of their own empowerment there of the citizens in Ferguson. The Force is about the Oakland Police Department and relations there that are more or less directly involved with race. Other ones, it's part of the situation that we find there, but not necessarily the central part. A film called Quest is a 10-year chronicling of a family in Philadelphia. It's a black family. That's not the only thing it's about, but that's part of it. Strong Island looks at a murder told through the film, the murder of the filmmaker's brother, and that's, again, a black family, though race is not the only thing that that film is about, so we're seeing it there. And that's I think that's smart on the part of the programmers to pull together things that are contemporary and that we're talking about, certainly still talking about police violence and police relations, but then also putting these other films in where race is part of the film, but it's not just what the film's about.
Do you see any of these getting even more attention after True False?
Some of them won't be for everybody. There's a film called Safari that is a condemnation of the hunting culture in Africa, the safari culture. It's beautifully put together, very meticulously edited. They've cast this Austrian family to be the hunters and the villains of the film, and that perfectly cast. There's so many things that are right about it, but the last portion of the movie, there's large game animal slaughter. So you're going to see a zebra slaughtered. You're going to see a giraffe slaughtered. A lot of people won't want to see that. I think Communion is another film I haven't mentioned, a Polish film that's a brother-sister relationship, but older sister who's taken on some adult responsibilities, and the family wants to see that her younger brother gets through his first communion. That looks like it'll be funny and touching at the same time. I think that's one to see.
Is there anything else that you're looking forward to this year's fest?
They're doing a few things that they've done before. So they're having the provocations again, where somebody will come in and basically give a little lecture before some of the films. And so I'm excited about that. Every one of those I saw last year was terrific. I'm excited to see that back again. One director I'll mention is the great Steve James is back again with his new movie, Abacus, which it looks at the banking crisis back in the Wall Street crash, and the fact that the one bank that was prosecuted was a small family-owned bank in Chinatown. And there's elements of racism to that, and just a head scratcher as to why that would be the one that would take on. So anything Steve James does is good. People know him best from Hoop Dreams. More recently had The Interrupters, which was very popular at True False a number of years ago. Life Itself, the biography of Roger Ebert. So whenever Steve James is here, his movies are good. Whenever he opens his mouth to speak, whether it's in a Q&A or you run into him on the street, everything he says is brilliant. So he's the biggest star, I suppose, of the directors here. But great rising stars. Kitty Green, who did casting JonBenet, certainly a rising star who's really pushing the envelope of what documentaries are and how to tell stories there. So that's another great thing about True False. You get these elder statesmen like Steve James, and you get these upcoming creative filmmakers who want to change what we've been watching.
You're listening to Intersection on KBIA. We just heard from Stacey Wolfel, director of the Jonathan B. Murray Center for Documentary Journalism, about noteworthy films and directors visiting True False this weekend. One director he mentioned was Steve James. Known for films like Hoop Dreams and Life Itself, James is returning to True False this year with his film Abacus. Abacus tells the story of the only bank to face criminal charges after the 2008 financial crisis. I spoke with James to learn more about his film. I thought we could start with you telling me how you came across this story and decided to make this film.
It was a story that that no one outside of the Chinese press in New York City was really covering at all. My producer, one of the producers on the film, Mark Mitten, is friends with the Sung family. They were saying to him, you know, we're going through this extraordinary thing right now. He then reached out to me and said, you know, there's this really crazy story happening in New York with this small bank. We went and we shot for a few days to sort of get a sense of it. And based on that, I was, you know, I was hooked and like, yes, let's tell this story. It's an important story.
It was interesting that you said that you got hooked with it, because I felt the same way when I was watching it. Was like, when I watch things, I try and be skeptical of like main characters or things like that, because I try and remain neutral. But it was so hard for me not to be rooting for them throughout the whole film.
Yeah, well, and that's exactly how we felt. I mean, this film, I feel like this film, it's clear fairly early on whose corner we're in, and I think we're justifiably in their corner. But nonetheless, it was important to articulate the case against them, even though the film is, you know, I think squarely in the corner of the Sungs, because I feel like even when you know the case against them, it doesn't ultimately have the merit.
You mentioned this was one of your first times doing kind of an investigative film. You said you'd never done a film with courtroom drama before. So what was that like, taking on this new kind of project?
There are several struggles with a film like this. One is, you know, the of course, when you go into a situation to do a film that takes place around a trial, what you sincerely hope for is to be able to be in the courtroom.
Yeah.
Right. And sometimes you can get that. And in this case, we could have been in there if everyone had consented to it, if the judge, the prosecution, and the defense had consented to it. But without all three consenting to it, we couldn't get in there. So we weren't able to be in the courtroom for the trial. So we hired this, you know, fabulous artist to go in, and she spent a few days in court, did a bunch of drawings that I knew would ultimately become the basis for sort of visualizing the court proceedings. The other thing we weren't able to get access to was the defense, I mean, the prosecution during the trial, only after. We didn't even get access to the defense lawyers during the trial. Basically, we had access to the family during the trial, and that was it. And after spending some time with the family and filming with them and having our idea about how to deal with the courtroom stuff, you know, I decided that was enough, because the family was so compelling and so interesting and so funny and so unique.
Was it difficult after spending a lot of time with a subject and maybe building a relationship with them to then have to ask them those tough questions and almost like not accuse them of mm-hmm. things, but ask them of things right. that they'd already told you they hadn't done?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, you know, at that, you're right. At that point, we had definitely formed a real relationship with them. Nonetheless, it had to be done. And if you were to look at the raw footage of the interviews where that happened, you would see that, you know, I didn't hold back. Mm-hmm. and neither did they.
Your previous work has been more like profiling people at certain moments in their lives. And in a way, this is also kind of profiling that family. How do you work with subjects to get them used to having cameras following them around so much?
You know, I'm a big believer in just, you know, and try to build that kind of relationship with your subject so that they like, frankly, having you around and yeah. and enjoy your company, as well as, you know, being on board with what it is the film's to be about. So I think those are the key for me, is you put in the time and you build the relationships. That's the key.
And something that stood out to me in the film was the portrait shots of the characters that you would have. Are those portrait shots something that you do in a lot of your work, or I guess what made you decide to do those and incorporate them in the film?
I've tried them on other films mm-hmm. in the filming. I've done them twice before, but they never ended up in the film.
Yeah.
because, you know, when we got into editing, it just didn't seem like it fit or worked, yeah. but it felt like it fit here, in part because of the sort of pride within the Chinese community and the mm-hmm. pride of the Sungs, the kind of dignity. And there was something about, I think, the portraits. The ones that are the most resonant and meaningful are the ones that are either of the family or of citizens in Chinatown.
This is Intersection. I'm the show's producer, Claire Banderas. This week, we're hearing from directors who will be at the True False Film Festival this weekend. I spoke with Laura Checkaway about her short film, Edith and Eddie. What begins as a love story of America's oldest interracial newlyweds quickly turns into an intimate look at the problems of the legal guardianship system. I was curious, like, how you kind of came across that story and how you decided to make this film about it.
A photo of Edith and Eddie had gone viral because they were being called America's oldest interracial newlyweds. And a friend actually texted me a picture of them that she thought that I would just appreciate. And my heart like leapt out of my chest when I saw the photo, and I just kept looking at it and I wanted to see more of them. So I looked into who had posted the photo and contacted a journalist. Then one thing led to another, and I was invited down to Virginia to meet them. You know, in the beginning, I thought that it was a sweet love story about this couple who had been reawakened by each other. And, you know, they met each other late in life and they had a spark. And then it pretty quickly took a really dark turn.
You kind of have these expectations of what your project is going to be. And then all of a sudden, all these unexpected things start happening. And what was going through your mind, and how did your project change when all of that was happening?
Well, you know, that's part of the adventure of documentary, is that you set out to make one story and often you end up with another. And being there and witnessing Edith being taken out of her home against her will and her right, you know, I had a sense that something awful was going on there, but I didn't know the magnitude of it. And it actually took, because I didn't know anything about the legal guardianship system. So I was in complete disbelief witnessing what was happening with Edith and Eddie, and then in even further disbelief to find out that this is actually an epidemic that is happening to elders all across the country. And I really want this film to help open a conversation and about the, you know, not only about honoring elders and elder rights and elder abuse, but also specifically about the flaws of the legal guardianship system, which I think is like, it's a vein within, you know, elder rights and elder abuse that is very specific and that a lot of people just don't know about.
And you started as a journalist, right?
I did, yeah.
How has that been different for you?
As a journalist, I was always told to, you know, just be an observer. And when it comes to filmmaking, you know, you really are immersed on a whole nother level. Going with your heart is key.
The more I've learned about documentaries and watched different filmmakers and heard about their styles, it's kind of struck me that like filmmakers kind of set their own individual code of ethics. So some filmmakers are heavily involved and even can become like characters in their films while others try and like be more reserved.
Yeah, and it's interesting to hear you say that because I don't appear in my films at all. However, I think that my heart like bleeds through all of the work, and it was bleeding pretty heavy on this one. And so even if the filmmaker themselves doesn't have a physical or, you know, audible presence, that the lens is still conveying that.
This week on Intersection, we're talking with directors whose films will be shown at the True False Film Festival this weekend. Reporter Anna Perez spoke with Hubert Peck, the producer of the Oscar-nominated film I Am Not Your Negro. The film was directed by Raoul Peck. The film centers on the works of James Baldwin. Baldwin was a novelist, playwright, poet, and social activist who wrote about his experience as a black man in white America.
Were you familiar with some of James Baldwin's works before making the film?
For Raoul, Baldwin has had always been an important part of his life. He started reading Baldwin, between high school and college. And from that point on, Baldwin has always been a companion. And sometime around the time he was a full adult, realized that even in his films or whatever he did, some of his thoughts, the way he framed things, were really coming out of the way Baldwin helped him frame things or help us frame things. We find that for a lot of people, Baldwin comes into their mind or into their life much later than we feel he should be part of their lives much earlier.
What is your favorite line or quote of Baldwin's work?
There are so many because as you watch the film, any of the sentences that are uttered or that Baldwin uses can be a documentary on their own. I think there's one that comes to mind right now, a line where he says, not everything we face can be changed, but nothing can be changed unless we face it. So I think that that's one that sticks to mind at least this week. Because every time I see the movie or pick up a Baldwin book, there's so much in there that sticks in your mind.
Is there anything specific that you are looking forward to while visiting Colombia?
Well, I'm very curious about Colombia, so I want to be surprised. One of the things that I'm looking for in terms of the work itself is the event that we're going to have with some of the students in Colombia on Wednesday morning, I believe. And also, of course, I can't wait to see the festival audience's reaction to the film.
What are some of the biggest challenges you had when making the film?
There were different challenges. I mean, at every stage from pre-production to post-production and even marketing. This is a film that was produced over a 10-year period. There were issues in terms of clearing rights for a lot of the archival material in the film. There were issues in terms of fundraising and finding partners. But, you know, that's what happens when you want to create something and have control over it. And so it means that to have control, you have to be willing to do the hard work of funding it yourself and finding the funders that will allow you, that will give you time to work on the project.
Is there anything that you're hoping the audience can take away from watching the film?
Once you see the film, it's hard for you to come out of the film kind of saying, I didn't know this. Once you've been exposed to the film, then it makes you question certain things. It makes you question certain things about the way things are today for us as a society. We hope that this film will begin to have create some discussions around issues around race, issues around equality, and equity even, of what do we want from the public or the audience. I think we want to have conversations around what it means to be an American and what we can become as America. What do we want to happen together?
You're listening to Intersection. We just heard from reporter Ana Perez and producer Javier Peck of I Am Not Your Negro on what he hopes audiences will take away from the film. Our last conversation is with directors Petra Lataster-Chaish and Peter Lataster. Reporter Elena Rivera spoke with them about their film Miss Keats' Children.
I'd love to know first, how did you first find out about this story?
We were thinking for many years about making a new version or a Dutch version of the French film Être et Avoir. I don't know if you heard about it or maybe seen it. And we were also driven by the fact that we feel that the job of teacher is very undervalued. So we started to look for extraordinary teachers. And we basically asked all the directors of the Dutch primary schools if they could point us out some of their best and most valued teachers they have in their schools. One of the most special ones was a letter from a small school in a village in the south of Holland. The village is called Hapert. And the director of the school, Gerard Smetters, he wrote a kind of love letter of two full pages about his fantastic teacher, Keith Engels. And he described what she did and that she had set up a special class for immigrant and refugee children who live in the neighborhood.
What kind of did you think you were going to focus on, and did it change over the course of filming?
When we found out about Keith, discovered that she helps refugee children and immigrant children who came to Holland and are unable to speak Dutch. So we had to change a little bit in that sense that Keith also said immediately, I do allow you to film in my class and I do allow you to film with me, but the focus has to be on the children.
How did you go about kind of capturing each child's individual personalities while also kind of showing the way that their presence impacted the rest of the kids around them?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, we focused on, tried to focus on the interaction between the children. So we were always interested in how they would communicate because of their language barrier. So you never really focus on one single child. There's always something going on between one child and the other child. So that was, yeah, it was very important to us that you could see that, how they progress through, you know, getting to know each other better and understanding each other and kind of learning how some social rules work.
What do you think the importance of your film is now in this political context, and what does it have to say?
There's a kind of other kind of political current or strategy here in Netherlands and also in other European countries, is that we shouldn't make life for refugees comfortable. And that also applies to education. And at the same time, the other side is that these children, like any other child, these children have a right to education. So as soon as they enter the Netherlands, within 3 weeks, they are obliged to go to school. And for the idea of these teachers in this school and the director is that we have to do whatever we can to give these children a good start, because this start is so essential for their coming life in Holland, and it will help them become good citizens. And if we don't do that, we'll get the problems later. We feel that, and the teachers with us feel that these are children, and it doesn't matter where they come from, and the children have a right to as good as possible a future and a good as possible education. And we shouldn't be talking about where they come from or what religion they have, and simply give them what's good for them and give them the best.
What's one thing that surprised you, or one thing that you learned while you were filming that you weren't expecting?
I found wonderful what a huge joy it was for the children to go to school and to learn. They couldn't learn very often because they come from war zones, and when they came into the school, the most of the children were so glad that they could start learning writing and reading. It meant freedom for them.
That was Petra Letoster-Chaish and Peter Letoster speaking with reporter Elena Rivera about their film Miss Keach Children. It will be playing this weekend at the True False Film Festival. Thank you for joining us here on Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. Thank you to our reporters Anna Perez, Michaela Tucker, and Elena Rivera, and our producers Kelly Polachek, Colin Crabb, and Abby Ivory Gagne. Our host is Sarah Shariari. If you want to listen to the show again, you can visit us online at kbia.org and find Intersection under the Shows tab. You can also follow us on Facebook to stay up to date with our show. Our music is Montana Skies. I'm Claire Banderas for Intersection here on KBIA 91.3 FM.